Hi, everyone. Welcome to Josh Nason's Punch Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I am, of course, Josh Nason, writer, editor, and podcaster of the website. It is Monday the 15th as I'm recording this intro. We are post-UFC St. Louis. However, this is not what this show is about. This is a continuing look back at 2017, the year that was, and we're looking back at Q3. That would be July, August, and September, which probably was the three biggest months for the world of MMA and really for the UFC, partially because one of their fighters and their top fighter didn't even fight in the UFC. He fought outside, fighting in a boxing match against Floyd Mayweather Jr. Of course, that would be the one and only Conor McGregor. So we talk about that in the show, as well as John Jones, who really had the highs and the trials and tribulations, the highs and lows, the ups and downs of John Jones, no further illustrated than the highs of coming back in July, defeating rival Daniel Cormier to reclaim the title, calling out Brock Lesnar, big money fights on the horizon, and then all of a sudden, weeks later, busted by USADA once again, and disgraced, title stripped, and all that good stuff. So all this happened during that three-month period of time, and joining me to do this is the Fight Network's Cody Saftick. Cody joined me for, about 90 minutes? He was a past guest, as you guys remember. So 90-minute show, we went over all kinds of stuff that happened. There was so much that happened in July alone, it probably could have been its own show. But regardless, this is an entertaining look back again as we kind of start to get into the year that is 2018. It's amazing to kind of look at all these little things that happened during 2017. While it was a down year, very eventful year. So without further ado, let's get to it. A 90-minute edition of the Josh Nason's Punch-Out Podcast with Fight Network's Cody Saftick, and after that, I'll give you a few thoughts on UFC St. Louis from last night. Easy for me to say. See you in a little bit. Enjoy. Well, we continue our look back at the world of mixed martial arts in 2017, even though we've turned the corner into 2018. And to do that, bringing back one of our favorite guests from the past year, you remember him from the Fight Network, Cody Saftick, joins us back here on Josh Nason's Punch Out. And Cody, we'll start out with the real tough questions first. What grade should I give Star Wars?
That's a good question. You know what? It's hard for me to say because I go and I watch this stuff and it looks badass. It looks very visually appealing, but I always feel like if you go out and you say, this is an awesome movie, there's always some diehard out there that completely picks it apart. So I'm thinking personally, like a B+, A-, but I feel like someone else is just going to rip me apart and be like, oh, it was so factually incorrect and it had this and it had that. And they just rehashed old storylines. So yeah, it's tough for me to say, but I enjoyed it personally.
You did, yes. So I enjoyed it. I'm going to give it a C+ for being average. It was average. And I really liked Force Awakens. But I'm going to watch it again because I think always these movies, like, everything kind of just hits you at once, you know, and you're kind of like taking everything in and trying to notice every single thing. And sometimes you miss some of the story or vice versa. But I thought it was I was entertained by it, but I really liked Rogue One. I really liked Force Awakens. And I thought this one was I thought it was good. It didn't blow me away, but I thought it was good. I finally saw it last night and managed to my buddy and I had to go to a late showing. And let's see. So I got back here at the house about 1 a.m. and I have to be up at 6 to help my wife get out of the house and then take care of my daughter until my mother-in-law shows up. So it was not running on much sleep today, Cody. I'll tell you that.
Well, I'll tell you something. Maybe it's that my expectations were low and that's why I enjoyed it, because the previous movie that I had seen before that was Suburbicon with Matt Damon. Mm. And I'm not even kidding when I say perhaps the worst movie I've ever seen in my entire life. I would not recommend it to anybody. I would give it negative 10 stars if that was a possible rating. It was the biggest piece of crap I've ever seen. So anything, it was an upgrade from that. And yeah, this is a fun movie, so I didn't mind it.
You know what movie I saw over the holiday break that I enjoyed? It's kind of been on my queue for a while and finally got a chance to sit down and watch it, was Arrival. Have you seen that?
I have not.
You haven't? Okay. So I won't spoil anything because it was up for an Academy Award with Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner's in it, Forest Whitaker's in it, and it's basically about not a speech pathologist, but an interpreter, someone that understands language. So Amy Adams plays this person, knows all kinds of languages and how people interact with each other, and essentially aliens visit Earth, and she is recruited to learn how to basically interact with the aliens, and things kind of take off from there. And going into it, I'm like, I'm always willing to give movies a chance, but I really kind of didn't know what was what it was going to all be about, and how it must have get nominated for an Academy Award. It's really good. Like, afterwards, it's one of those movies that kind of you sit there and you're like, wow, okay. And it kind of like stays with you for a little while. I kind of think through some stuff, and it's one of those questions. It makes you ask a lot of questions at the end, not related to aliens, if that makes sense. So it's on HBO right now for those that have it. Arrival. I would highly recommend giving that a view.
Okay, most definitely. Yeah, I think I'm going to do that because, what I wanted to do was go out to theaters and check out that movie, All the Money in the World, which is a Ridley Scott movie. Basically, billionaire's grandson gets kidnapped, and the kidnappers look, we're going to get a bunch of money out of this rich guy. He's an oil tycoon. He's got so much money. And then the billionaire grandfather's like, I wouldn't give a cent for my grandchild because I have 12 grandchildren, and if I give you a ransom, then that's going to put them all at risk. So I was like, man, that's an awesome concept based on a true story, but because of this freezing rain that we're getting right now, I don't think I'm going to exit the house. So, like you said, HBO, I think we're going to hopefully throw that up.
All right. So Arrival, thumbs up. Suburbicon, thumbs down. And Star Wars, go check
it
out.
The most thumbs down. Okay. Yeah. Star Wars, thumb in the middle.
Exactly. Well worth the watch. I think that's the important thing. Well, let's go to a different form of entertainment. And what we're doing is, again, taking our walk down MMA memory lane, finishing up with 2017. Looking at Q3. So this is July, August, September. And Cody, you really got the pick of the litter here. This is an interesting couple months, mainly because of this one fight square in the middle of the quarter, which was I assume you probably heard about it. Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor had a little boxing tilt in Las Vegas that did a huge amount of business. So that happened. It's a very interesting quarter. Obviously, as people have said, kind of a down year for MMA as compared to 2016. But we'll kick off with July. And again, what we do for those that have not heard this before, not heard these shows before, I kind of go through every month. I use the Bloody Elbow archives, and I go through and kind of look at all the different stories, pick out some of the big headlines, notable news, and some of the big events, and kind of pull out a few of the top ones to go through. And then we'll kind of go through quick hit on the bullets and see what Cody has to say about a few of these. But we'll start off in July, and I would say I'm going to start UFC first. So one of the big things of the month really was the return of Jon Jones, UFC 214. Jon Jones returning after a year-long absence due to obviously USADA violation, and this was the grudge match against Daniel Cormier, his longtime rival. This fight had been on and off seemingly for forever. Finally, we're going to get it at a year later from when we were supposed to get it, at UFC 214. Didn't really know, of course, what Jon Jones was going to look like. He was talking the part, looked the part, and was going after the light heavyweight title that he technically never really lost. He didn't lose in the cage. And he goes in there, and he looks great against Daniel Cormier, knocking him out in the third round, reclaiming the gold. And this was an interesting fight for so many reasons. Obviously, the result and there's so many different angles about this. So obviously, Jon Jones kind of almost like a redemption story in a lot of ways, and again, kind of isolating down into this fight, not what happened afterward. But he reclaimed the gold. We had these post-fight promos where Jones appeared to be the next big quote-unquote money superstar in UFC. Talking about Brock Lesnar. There was just all of a sudden a surge of interest in like, oh my god, this is going to be the next guy. Jon Jones is really back. Obviously, the unfortunate Daniel Cormier promo after that, where he obviously very tearful, a lot of kind of controversy about Joe Rogan actually talking to him afterward. But this was, this was for MMA, and this was my event of the year. We'll talk a little bit about that more in a second. But this was, Jon Jones, the guy coming back, and for one night, and again, we knew it was going to happen later. But for one night, he was the king of the fighting world. This was in a summer that was so focused on boxing and our guy going to the boxing world. This was fun to have a major MMA fight and a superstar reclaim his gold.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you look at it for what it was, and I think you nailed it best when you said 2017 almost seemed to be a down year for MMA. And I think what people mean when they say that oftentimes is that when you're looking at mixed martial arts as a whole, it's like, well, who are the big stars? And obviously one of the big stars for the last number of years has been Ronda Rousey. And, you know, at this point, she's officially done. She did not have a fight in 2017. And I think, you know, the fans and the pundits really kind of missed her. And then you have Conor McGregor, and then it's important to note that he had the boxing match, but outside of that, not much in terms of MMA. So now you're scraping, okay, who else do we have? We have George St. Pierre. Obviously, he came back at the later part of the year, but not really a factor. I mean, he's been off for 3-4 years. Who are those stars? And then that's when you go to John Jones. John Jones is, in my opinion, the greatest American fighter of all time. He's perhaps the greatest pound-for-pound fighter of all time. He's an undefeated champion. You know, he's one of those guys that you look at his one loss being a disqualification to Matt Hamill. Outside of that, the man has been near perfect. And not perfect in the sense that he goes out there and he smashes everybody and it's not fun. Perfect in the sense that he'll go out there and have a fight of the year against an Alexander Gustafsson. He'll go out there and he'll have, you know, he'll fight the best guys and he'll give you fun performances. John Jones should be a much bigger star, but unfortunately the choices that he makes outside of the cage are seemingly the reasons why he hasn't really hit that peak. But in 2017, I think the UFC, they needed a guy like Jones to come back and have a big performance and kind of put himself back in the history books as one of the best fighters in the world. And that's exactly what he did at UFC 214. Now, of course, we're looking at this for what it is, and that's the event itself. Afterwards is when you kind of get that gray spot and the positive test yet again, and the John Jones suspended by USADA yet again. But at that moment, it was huge. I mean, they were coming off a string of not bad events by no stretch of the imagination, but not great events. And UFC 214 was a great event. I mean, outside of the Tyron Woodley, Damian Maia co-main event, it was a solid event. You got Volkan Oezdemir, who got the KO over Jimmy Manuel really fast. Nice knockout. He put himself on the map. Robbie Lawler versus Donald Cerrone was an awesome fight. Cyborg versus Tonya Ebinger. I mean, Tonya Ebinger really gave her a test, right? It wasn't exactly a competitive fight, but it really got to show you how good Christian Cyborg Destino really is. And Tonya Ebinger is obviously very tough, very durable, kind of was able to give her a dance partner that would allow her to go multiple rounds. And then the main event, you know, not a fight of the year, but certainly in the discussion of top 20 best fights of the year, Daniel Cormier comes out very good first two rounds. John Jones KOs him in the third, spectacular head kick. First man to defeat Daniel Cormier, only man to defeat him, defeats him again, and the first man to finish him. I just thought it was a spectacular event. The shame is that John Jones is really as good as I think he is. People will say, you know, well, this man's on steroids. So if you look at baseball players, whether it's a Roger Clemens or whether it's a Barry Bonds or whether it's a Mark McGwire, they don't even have positive drug tests. Just the speculation is that they probably cheated, and because they're unwilling to admit it, they can't get into the Hall of Fame. Should John Jones be admitted to the Hall of Fame? That's a gray area. I mean, he's competing with a lot of guys that were probably on something themselves. But at the same time, you can't go in there into a blood sport where you got to bash somebody and do steroids. But I just look for skill-wise. Does he need them? I don't know. He did come into this fight looking unbelievably shredded. If you look at past performances, he's more of a lengthy, lean fighter. And coming into this rematch with Daniel Cormier, you got, you know, the powerlifting John Jones that we saw against Aubin St. Preux, but a different, more dynamic version of him. It's tough to say if he'd be as good if he was a clean athlete, but I really do think that even without the steroids, his accomplishments speak for themselves. He really is one of the greatest fighters of all time. And I think that the UFC needed this event. You know, it was a thrilling event. Everybody was talking about it for the next day, the day after, the week after. You still got headlines coming out of it. It was a very interesting card. So, I thought that UFC 214 was, I don't want to say a grand slam, but it was certainly a home run for the UFC.
Yeah, I remember just the feeling of excitement, and as we've kind of gone through this year so far, we kept waiting for those turn the corner moments when the year was really gonna. It felt like almost like kickoff, and like that interest, that buzz, we were gonna feel it. And this show had it, and that fight had it, and afterwards it was like there was possibilities. You know, you thought about Jones returning to fight against, you know, Alexander Gustafsson, the possibilities there. People are talking about Oezdemir a little bit, but really it was Gustafsson. But then when he utters the name Brock Lesnar, that opens up a new can of worms completely. And just thinking about the possibilities there, obviously Lesnar a lot closer to the end of his career, if he's not obviously at the end right now, but just that superstar factor. And you thought that maybe, you know, a year from July, if that was to happen, that would have been huge. And then obviously what was going to happen later on with Jones failing, it just for this one night, it felt like possibilities were endless. And you mentioned kind of going down the rest of the card, obviously Tyron Woodley defeating Damian Maia to retain his welterweight title by unanimous decision, really kind of answering the question of would he be able to handle Maya's jiu-jitsu, and this is kind of starting the decline of Maia, as we've seen a little bit later in the year. But Tyron Woodley, kind of an unheralded victory because it wasn't the most aesthetically pleasing, but and this would obviously open up a little bit more discussion or public controversy between him and Dana White, which we'll get to in a second. But you also, as you mentioned down the card, Robbie Lawler defeating Donald Cerrone in essentially a dream fight in a three-round dream fight, defeating him by unanimous decision in a very fun fight. Volkan Ozdemir, we just talked about, knocking out Jimmy Manoa in just 42 seconds to open up the pay-per-view. That was obviously a punctuation point for sure. Cyborg, Justino claiming the 145-pound title. TKOing Tony Evinger in the third round, I believe, to win that title. And also on the undercard. The undercard was pretty fun as well. Some interesting names. Aljamain Sterling beating out Henan Barrow. And then Ricardo Lamas showing that he was still a force to be reckoned with at 145, knocking out or TKOing Jason Knight, who is a guy on the rise. Hick Diaz, as you were, leading off the prelims. So as a whole, and I think you wrapped up really nicely, was that UFC 214, it wasn't a grand slam, but it was a very long home run for the UFC, and I think that's something that they needed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, basically MMA, like any pro sports, is you're trying to tell a story, and when you talk about kind of, start the decline of Damian Maia, like, you don't know that at the time. Damian Maia is on such a huge winning streak, and will he be able to get Tyron Woodley down? It's like, oh, this guy's taking down everybody. And, I mean, he's fought great wrestlers. He's fought Jake Shields. He's fought John Fitch. He's fought Rory McDonald, and he's scored takedowns against all of them. There's basically been very, 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 very few men who ever stuffed Damian Maia's takedowns, because he can, for a guy that is a jiu-jitsu fighter, I mean, he's got a good chain wrestling game, and he's super strong. Once he gets that rear waist lock on you, he'll dump you. He's got good foot sweeps. He's got a great single leg. He turns the corner fantastic on it. Tyron Woodley's stuffing, 21, 22 takedowns? Mm. I mean, it shows you how good of a wrestler Woodley is, but it starts to decline for Damian Maia. You could also make the argument that Robbie Lawler versus Donald Cerrone fight, a great fight, but it starts to decline for Donald Cerrone. I mean, everything, it's not like, that's the beauty about pro wrestling. You can drop a fight and then you can just come back. You know, you can rewrite the story. You can get on a roll again. In MMA, you can do the same thing, but it also, you get some of these battles where you're just never going to be the same. And it's interesting to see now moving to 2018. Will Donald Cerrone come back? Will Damian Maia come back? Will John Jones beat the USADA testing program and, get his suspension turned down and come back? I mean, it's all super interesting storylines. With John Jones and Brock Lesnar, I mean, that would have been, when you think about the UFC as a business model and you think that the fans might not want these money fights, but the UFC wants these money fights. They want to try to put together the biggest fight possible. And oftentimes when you think about, well, what's the biggest fight possible? I suppose Conor versus George St. Pierre, that would be one of the biggest fights possible. John Jones fighting anybody at 205 at this point, it's just not a money fight. It's not that big marquee fight. Him versus Stipe Miocic, which is the fight that I want to see, not a money fight. Him versus Brock Lesnar, that would have been blockbuster. That would have been one of those pay-per-views that is guaranteed to sell a million pay-per-view buys, because there's intrigue. You have Brock, who's always been a good pay-per-view draw to begin with. You have John Jones, who's a mediocre pay-per-view seller. But you pair them together in this one guy is the greatest light heavyweight champion of all times, moving up a weight class to take on a man who's a former champion in his own right, who's, conceivably twice his size. And because he has that wrestling pedigree, I mean, maybe that's the trick to beating John Jones. Can't necessarily stand with John Jones. We've seen how dynamic he is. But if you take this guy down, you're twice the size and you pound on him, maybe it gets interesting. Those are the kind of fights that people gravitate towards. I mean, when you think about it, and we're going to talk about it, but Floyd Mayweather versus Conor McGregor, it's the question mark of it's so crazy, and it's such a strange stylistical matchup that there's intrigue. Well, what's going to happen? One side says this is going to happen. The other side says this is going to happen. But truthfully, nobody knows what's going to happen. So that's what makes it interesting, and that's why it sells so well. And I think John Jones versus Brock Lesnar, exactly, it had that. It had that mystique around it. It had that mystery, and it had two big names. So the fact that he would later fail the test and kind of take that fight off the table, yeah, that kind of sucked for sure. But, I mean, the opportunity for him to go up and fight Stipe, or could you imagine a Francis Ngannou versus John Jones? Like, it would just open so many doors had he not failed that test. But, yeah, if we're looking at this event for what it was, it was super entertaining, and it falls dead smack in the summer. You know, it was a nice summer night. You get your group of buddies together like old times, and you watch an awesome event. It just, the whole thing felt, to me anyways, it felt good. It felt like a throwback to the good days where you are excited for fights and they do deliver. It's not one of these cards where, you know, the cat, your buddies come over and they don't really know who's on the card, and it might be entertaining, but this kind of had it all. It had the three title fights. It had the big names. It had multiple fights of the night. It had that intrigue. It had the return of one of the greatest ever. It had a highlight reel KO to cap off the night. So, yeah, I enjoyed it very much so.
We then go to two other big stars who are in the throes of promotion for their August duel, Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor, and kind of going through all the stuff that happened in this month, and I don't even have every single thing down and going through these headlines because everything was a headline. Everyone was trying to get every little bit of news and trying to get every little bit of fan interest to their website to do this. But let me kind of go through some of the big points of the month, and this was all about promotion. Some of the stuff I forgot about. So you had the press tour, the four city press tour within L.A., Toronto, New York, and then London. We obviously had the Los Angeles kickoff, which was a very dull event. We had the mic shutting off controversy there. It was all these were really boxing, classic boxing interviews or press conferences in a sense. In that it just was kind of unstructured and you had to wait a long time and so on and so forth. So for how bad Los Angeles was, you take the flip to Toronto, which was completely different. It was a tremendous event. It was fun to watch. It was Esther Lynn this past year was on my show, and she was talking about shooting the event, and she really loved how the back of the venue was opened up. So it was outside without being outside, so there was like natural light in, and it just added a different element to everything as opposed to these dark arenas where they were doing the other stuff. And it was just a revelation in promotion for any type of fight sport. You had obviously the Brooklyn one, which was a complete disaster by all accounts. We talked to people that were there in the venue. I mean, just watching it was just bad. And obviously London was, at this point, it was kind of like, you know, do we really need to see this four times in 5 days or whatever it was? It was not good at all. We had the unfortunate, all types of things from these press conferences. We had the Conor McGregor's classic fuck you suit, which actually had pinstripes. I completely forgot about that. We obviously had the unfortunate gay slurs thrown around, the dance for me boy line. So the racial element starts getting thrown into this whole thing. And, so you kind of go from this press tour, the first videos were obviously released of this thing starting to hype. The price point of the pay-per-view, which to no surprise is going to be $99.95. The craziness kind of starting with Pauly Malignaggi, and this would actually end up kind of blowing over a little bit later in the month, but the Pauly Malignaggi was out there a lot talking about he was going to spar McGregor, and it was just – there was a lot of talk about this, and obviously a lot more come this later on. McGregor had an Instagram war with Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, of all people. This was and this was just a small amount of just the amount of promotion, talking points. Obviously, Floyd Mayweather Sr. was talking a lot. Everyone was talking. This was just like just chaotic in all senses of the word. When you think back to the promotional aspect and kind of everything we saw during that press tour and everything else in July, what stands out to you the most?
Yeah, definitely the Toronto tour, like the leg of the tour in Toronto, because I had the luxury of going there. And it was one of the highlights for me of the year. I mean, that place was ruckus. It was a party. You remember way back in the day, Dana White always used to make those comments where he'd be like, oh, Toronto's the mecca of fighting. It's like, what's he talking? I'm from Toronto. I love the city. And I love that, you know, to say that Canada is the mecca. I love that. But like, what are you talking about, man? Like, if anything, you know, Japan or Brazil, like go to one of those countries. But what he meant by that is we sell pound for pound, we sell a ton of pay-per-views out of Canada because they love their fighting. They get behind it and they support these things. And when they came to Toronto, it was exactly that. It was honestly, Josh, it was a party. They sold tickets. They were selling beer in there. People showed up in the thousands. They completely packed up the entire place. And it was open to the media. I mean, I was there as part of the media. So we had like our own section that was overseeing kind of all the general fans. And the general fans are what led to that being such a spectacular press conference because they showed up, majority of them being Conor McGregor fans. they showed up and they just gave it such a vibe and gave it such a cool feeling. Once again, it's outdoor venue on an awesome summer day, and everyone's just feeling it. People are coming from all over the city or coming from basically all over different parts of Ontario. When we talk to people, they made the trek to come down. And basically what happened was they were originally supposed to go to the Sony Center, and they were going to sell tickets at the Sony Center, and it sold out so quick. They were like, we got to move this to a bigger venue. So they go to Budweiser Garden, which generally holds concerts. And that's what it felt like. It felt like we were at a rock show. And both guys delivered. I mean, I feel like if you're going to look at that for what it was, and that's a four-leg tour event, you're going to run out of material. But even more so, because they left it all on the line in Toronto. They used all their good bits. That once they got to Brooklyn, you've got Conor McGregor dressing like an idiot, wearing like a mink jacket with a dragon on the back of it. And by the time they got to Europe, it was like, oh man, we're both tired. They're probably both sick, because think about it. You're dealing with thousands of people. You're meeting people. You're shaking hands. Yep. You're getting on a plane. You're not sleeping properly. You're not training properly. You're not eating properly. All these different things go into it that once they got there, I mean, they had just run out of material. Conor was sweating like a pig when they were in England. They were sitting on that stage. He was just sweating. Well, I think it was his birthday, too. I mean, it's just like you could tell that they weren't really in it. But for that moment in Toronto, both men delivered unbelievably. And it was a highlight for me, too, because I got to interview Conor McGregor, and I got to interview Floyd Mayweather, and I got to interview Dana White, and they were all there. And we basically got these they would break it up in scrums kind of in the back media part, and they would walk along. And, you know, Ariel Helwani made the trek down, and you've got a bunch of other, you know, good MMA names. Esther's there taking pictures. One of the greatest pictures of the entire tour that she took is both of them squaring off on that stage in Toronto, pointing at each other. The whole bring it on. You have the crowd in the background. I mean, it was just, it almost felt like a magical moment. And I think that's what promotion's all about. To put things in comparison, George St. Pierre, you know, Canada's biggest star, the guy that Dana White's got on record multiple times saying is the pay-per-view king. He comes out of retirement, takes on Michael Bisping. He's moving up a weight class. He's challenging for the middleweight title. He's looking to do what only three other men have ever done, and that's win a world title in the UFC at two different weight classes. And it's a great moment. They had that press conference at the Hockey Hall of Fame. There was 100 people in there, right? It was completely night and day from what they did with Conor McGregor versus Floyd Mayweather. And that's when people say, you know, the marketing machine. Well, what is the marketing machine? That is when the promotion puts their resources behind you and they market this thing properly. And you've got Mayweather's outfit behind it. And you've got McGregor, who had his own promotional outfit, which he just created getting into it. And you have the UFC, you have Zoufa, and you have all these different elements, and everybody's kind of putting all their resources behind marketing a big fight. You can make it a big deal. The thing is that you can't do that for every fight, because then it loses that magic. It loses that mystique. It loses that luster, so to speak. But they nailed it with Mayweather McGregor. I mean, for what it was, and let's be honest here, it's a freak show fight. It's the kind of thing that you would have seen in a Pride event back in the day. They really did a fantastic job of selling it as a legitimate fight and entertaining people the whole way through. And the other thing is, when you talk about how it kind of got a little bit racial and how it got a little bit dull, I point back to that as being that they used all their material early up. I mean, Conor didn't have anything left. He didn't have any zingers left. So instead, he started acting like an idiot and saying how he's black from the waist down. It's like, come on, man. Like, hire a comedy writer or something, but don't just go out there and struggling and just start saying the first thing that comes to your head, you know? When he grabbed that money bag in Toronto, when he grabbed that money bag and went to go throw it off that stage, that place erupted. People were losing it. When he opens the bag, says, that's it. You don't got no money. You know, like, it was just a great moment. But you can't keep up those great moments for too long. And that's where it kind of got oversaturated on the next two legs of that tour, right? They go to Brooklyn, and it was a bit of a, that was probably the worst of them. And then you try to cap it off in England. But again, it's like you kind of use that magic a little early on. But for me personally, I mean, I think that's marketing 101. That's how you sell a big event. That's how you make it as big as possible. And if that was the only tour that they did, if that was literally the only media day that they had, it would have gotten the job across anyways. Instead, they kind of drawn it out a little bit. But all the same, the event, it sold massively. It did fantastic. And I think all parties won in that scenario. It sucks for MMA fans that they didn't have a Conor McGregor fight in MMA, that they had to resort to watching him basically handcuffed. I mean, the guy is a kicker first and foremost. You're going to take away his ability to kick. You're going to take his ability that he can't wrestle here. He can't clinch. He can't do any of those things. He physically has to fight with two of his eight tools against the greatest boxer of all time. It's hard to watch because I'm very much one of those guys that gave Conor McGregor a 0% chance of winning that fight.
Yeah.
So you knew the outcome before the fight actually started, and he did better than expected. But, you know, I think that there's a little bit of charade and showmanship going into that as well. So as far as the marketing goes, yeah, Josh, it was fantastic. They did a very good job, and take it from me. I've been to a lot of these press conference events, and this one was special. This one was unique and it's unlike anything I've ever seen before.
So we'll go over the rest of the month, and looking at this list, this really could have been its own episode. This is arguably the best MMA month of the year. So I'm going to go through these, and then afterwards I'll ask you if there's anything on this that really stood out for you in the month. We start off with some results. We had obviously the Tough 25 show. Justin Gaethje versus Michael Johnson, a really fun fight of the year candidate. Obviously, some people say it was their fight of the year. Justin Gaethje winning by TKO in that fight and making his presence known in the UFC. Also on that show, Jesse Taylor completing his redemption story, submitting Diego Lima, and also Tisha Torres picking up a victory on this card, continuing her march towards getting what she hopes will eventually be a title shot. We'll talk about her a lot more by the year's end. We go to UFC 213. Unfortunately, the main event was scrapped. Amanda Nunes versus Valentina Shevchenko. The rematch was scrapped due to cyanitis, which Dana White said that Nunes was cleared to fight, but Nunes was like, I can't do this. So that was kind of a controversy there. Dana White saying, quote unquote, she won't headline again, which is interesting considering what would happen after the later in the year with after the Cyborg fight, who he wants to put against Cyborg, Amanda Nunes. So big surprise there. Robert Whittaker versus Yoel Romero for the interim middleweight title was put up as the main event, and Whittaker winning that one, edging out Yoel Romero to win that interim title. Let's see, Jacek actually offered to step in and fight Valentina Shevchenko, but that was turned down. If you remember, Anthony Pettis won a bloody affair over Jim Miller. Alistair Overeem edged out Fabricio Werdum, and that was UFC 213. We then go to UFC on Fox 25. Chris Weidman making a finally successful go in his home state of New York, submitting Kelvin Gastelum. Jermaine Rivera on that show also beating out Prospector. And at this point, still a young fighter. I think the Prospect label is shed in Thomas Almeida. UFC Glasgow, Santiago Ponzinibbio, somewhat controversial knockout over Gunnar Nelson. There was an eye poke controversy after the fight that really didn't go anywhere, but was the talk of a lot of the MMA Twitter world, so to speak. Cynthia Calvillo continuing a strong campaign in 2017 by beating Joanne Calderwood, and Paul Felder returning to the winner's circle, knocking out Stevie Ray. Conor McGregor's coach saying that Conor's not motivated by money. Imagine that. But he also expects he expects Conor to return to the UFC in December. Donald Cerrone versus Robbie Lawler was rescheduled for UFC 214, which we talked about. That was actually done earlier in the month. Dana White guarantees. I love putting these in, saying that Bisping will face the winner of Romero versus Whittaker, guaranteed. We all know how that one turned out. UFC Pittsburgh got Luke Rockhold versus David Branch as the main event. Bellator 183 got Paul Daly versus Lorenz Larkin. UFC Japan got Claudia Gadelha versus Jessica Andrade, and that will be notable for reasons we'll get into later. Dan Henderson and Sakuraba were booked for a grappling match in Ryzen. Ronda Rousey revealed that her house was broken into, Olympic stuff, and some other things were stolen, but that Travis Brown was able to scare the guys into dropping the stuff or running them off or whatever. She also appeared in the crowd at the WWE Mae Young Classic. That was notable. She had her friend, stablemate Shayna Baszler competing. And Rousey's interest in WWE, obviously interest continues to get closer and closer as we see, and perhaps we'll see that a little bit more coming up in 2018. UFC Japan also got OSP versus Shogun in a rematch as the main event. We learned that GSP texted Dana White and wants Michael Bisping in November in New York City. And then after the UFC 214 event earlier in the month, Dana White on that night saying that the ship had, quote unquote, turned around and that the fight is on after a very bad Woodley fight. Again, kind of continuing this Dana White Woodley public dispute. Frank Mir finally gets released from the UFC and able to sign wherever he want to. Obviously, the USADA suspension kind of still upholding there. Gegard Mousasi signed a 6-fight deal with Bellator, another big free agent going there. It was later in the month scheduled to fight Alexander Shlemenko at Bellator in October, an event that would also supposed to feature King Mo versus Liam McGeary. Joe Duffy re-signed with the UFC. Noon Shevchenko 2 was rescheduled for UFC 215, along with DJ versus Ray Borg. Stipe Miocic said he was going to be holding out until his contract issues with the UFC were resolved. Derek Campos beat Brandon Gertz in a very fun Bellator fight at Bellator 181. One of those fights that probably not a lot of people saw, but those that did really enjoyed it. Yoel Romero, we talked about him a few seconds ago, burned a picture of Michael Bisping holding the British flag in response to Bisping disrespecting him. The Dana White Contender Series kicked off with Kurt Hollibaugh winning in kind of an interesting format of the show. Guys getting contracts based on basically how Dana White thought they did. Not every winner would get one, but it was kind of interesting how they did it. It was in the Tough Gym. Not any UFC branding on it. It was all just Dana White's branding on it. So it was a very well-received show for those that did watch it every Tuesday night. So that kicked off in July. Demetrius Johnson won an ESPY over Conor McGregor for Fighter of the Year. Eddie Alvarez and Justin Gaethje were announced that they were going to coach the next season of Tough and then fight afterward. Michael Irvin, Hall of Famer, Dallas Cowboys, said he wants an MMA fight. HBO Real Sports did a pretty interesting piece. It got a lot of talk in the MMA world about the Chechenian head of Chechnya. I don't know what you call him, not prime minister, but I can't remember the guy's name, Serkinov or something like that.
Kadyrov.
That was it, Serkinov. Kadyrov. And basically his association with MMA, which started a bigger conversation about the UFC fighters that went over there to train and just a really bad situation in Chechnya. But that was a pretty big discussion point. Colby Covington started to really kind of heal it up this month, shades of what to come later in the summer. And then again, Tyron Woodley wants Dana White to apologize or else, quote unquote, he'll start leaking some shit. And that was your month of July. I'm telling you, there was a ton of stuff that happened that month. Out of all that, what do you remember? What stood out to you?
Yeah, well, I think you did a fantastic job of basically nailing the majority of the stuff that happened. It was a busy month. A lot of stuff's going on. The Dana White Contender Series thing was super interesting to me because as a fight fan, Tuesday night fight, I love that idea. I mean, everybody knows that come weekend time, you've got not priorities, but you've got obligations. You've got stuff you got to do. And I do a fantastic job of freeing up my weekend so I can watch the fight. But it's a little difficult when you've got Friday, Saturday fights every single weekend, especially when you've got Bellator running on the Friday, UFC running on the Saturday. I mean, it's every single weekend, week in, week out. But then Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, everything during the week, you're not getting anything. You basically sit and you wait, and then the weekend comes and you watch the fight. I love back when boxing used to have, fights midweek, right? That was awesome to me. When they had Monday night fights, when they had Friday night fights, when they had Wednesday night fights even, that was great to me. When Dana White's Contender Series announced that they were going to be doing these Tuesday night fight cards, that's awesome. Because what else is going on Tuesday night? Fantastic. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to watch five fights. They're mostly guys that I know anyways because in working at Fight Network, I've worked just a ton of what was originally RFA event, then also Legacy Fighting event, and then finally they merged into that LFA organization. And that's where most of the talent was coming from. So a lot of people would say, well, I don't know these guys. Yeah, you know Kurt Hollebaugh because he's a Strikeforce and UFC vet. But a lot of these other contenders, so to speak, that were emerging, people didn't really know them. I was very familiar with all these guys, and I was super excited. The thing is that the model's kind of – it doesn't work. It doesn't work for a number of reasons. A, it doesn't really have that UFC affiliation. So like you said, it was Dana White kind of fronting it himself. The problem with that is Dana White, who is a billionaire at this point, he's got money for days. But every businessman, in business, it's like in fighting, right? You're winning. Every day you go out there, you want to win. You're trying to win your whatever deal you're trying to accomplish, whatever merger you're trying to accomplish. You're trying to win. You're trying to advance the company, trying to become bigger. Nobody just likes losing money because losing, as it would imply, losing money is losing. And this model, it doesn't make sense because you're putting it in the Tough Gym and there's nobody there. So you can't sell tickets to it, right? And then it's free on Fight Pass. So like, who's paying to physically watch this? Nobody. It's Dana White in his loads and loads of money having people who he's got to pay to fly to the event, well, fly to Vegas. He's got to put them up in hotels. He's got to physically, get them into the Tough Gym. Then he's paying them to fight in these tough fights. They're tough, formats, the Tuesday night contender series. And then you're giving out basically, it was supposed to be one contract, but he ends up giving out two contracts. Almost every episode, he's giving out two contracts. Yeah. So now you've got two new guys going to the UFC every single week. Two more guys. So if you're a fight fan and you're trying to track this massive, ever growing roster, every single week, there's two more guys. And a lot of the time, Josh, it was guys that were 5-1. 6-0. You know, guys that were not ready to go to the UFC, but they happened to knock somebody out who was also at their level, and now all of a sudden, you know, you're skyrocketed to go to the UFC. I look at a Sage Northcutt, supremely talented kid. He's so young. He's very athletic. He will get better. He shouldn't have been in the UFC when he got thrown into the UFC. But what happened was Dana White happened to be in town because they were in that Dana White looking for a fight show where him and Matt Serra go around. They had Dean Thomas later on the show, and they look for prospects. Well, you're at an event. You got to find somebody. This guy looked good. You know who he fought that night? Rocky Johnson. The guy's got a 19-22 record. And yeah, he beat him. That guy's not even close to being UFC caliber, but he beat him, and he looked good doing it, so let's sign him. So as a result, the Tuesday Night Contender Series, to me, you're just throwing guys in that weren't really ready. And if you look at the record of the guys that came off that show that are currently in the UFC, it's like 50-50 at best because a lot of them just aren't ready. In fact, this weekend on the Sunday, we have that St. Louis card and Mike Santiago is fighting. He didn't even get a contract coming off his Dana White Contender fight. Literally, he fought on Tuesday, no contract. On Thursday, they had a short-notice replacement fight, and they called him up, and they said, yeah, can you come down? Like, they signed so many people, I think, for the casual fan, it gets broken down. But if I was to add one thing out of all the big stories and the big news that's coming, you go back to that UFC Japan card, which was Alvin St. Preux versus Yushin Okami. I mean, that fight was super lackluster. But you had the debut of Gokhan Saki on the card. And coming from that kickboxing background, I'm a huge fan of K1 kickboxing, Glory kickboxing. Gokhan Saki is a mean man. He is a bad dude, and I thought he was retired from kickboxing. So it was such a delight when I heard that he was going to be making an MMA debut. And to his credit, it looked like he was working on his wrestling. He had a little bit of counter wrestling. He seemed to get tired at the end of that first round, but Luis Henrique Silva took everything he threw at him and then finally succumbed to a strike. 4:45 or something in the first round, like 15 seconds left, he finally went down. Gokhan Saki got the win, but this guy's super entertaining, and I think the UFC needs him. First of all, he's from Turkey. They've always talked about having an event in Turkey. Turkey fans are super, 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 super loyal, and they will support their guys. He's a mega rock star over there, and so I think it's a good way to kind of breach more international fans coming in and watching him. And as well, giving him Henrique de Silva, that's awesome. They later tried to get him against Khalil Roundtree, which would have been a great time, but you know, styles make fights, and the UFC doesn't have to throw this guy to a former D1 collegiate All-American. They can give him guys that are going to play his game and stand in front of him and have entertaining fights, and that's exactly what he does. They call him the Turkish Mike Tyson because he puts guys out. And I get he's just 1-1 in MMA now, but seeing him get that debut, seeing him get what to me was like KO of the night, I loved it. I thought that was a huge moment for international fans and for a guy that's watched Gokhan Saki for a long time and meant a lot to me, so...
So we'll talk.
That was super cool. And yeah, like you said, I mean, we could have done an episode just on the month. It was a crazy time.
Certainly was. And we'll talk about more UFC Japan in a minute. But first, we will flip to August. And August was really all about one fight. And this was Mayweather versus McGregor. There was no other UFC events really that month. It was all just building towards this major show, which was happening near the end of the month. And we'll kind of, you know, this has been talked about to death, and obviously it'll be talked about a lot in the future as we kind of wait to see what McGregor does next. But we'll kind of, a few of the notes kind of leading up to this, and then obviously the fight itself. The 8-ounce gloves, 8-ounce gloves was approved. I remember being at my day job, and this was like the Nevada State Athletic Commission was discussing this, and immediately you're thinking, oh, wow, you know, lighter gloves, maybe that'll mean something, you know, potential for a knockout quicker or something like this. And who's it going to benefit? Is it going to benefit Conor, whatever? And then you realize that, you know, Mayweather has fought with 8-ounce gloves for basically the majority of his pro fights, I believe. So it was one of those things that headlines, it grabbed headlines, you know, smaller gloves, all this, but that Mayweather had really actually fought with these size gloves for most of his career. So it wasn't that big of a deal. This, what I was talking about with Pauly Malignaggi, this is really when everything kind of boiled over. There was video released of stills and a little bit of video released of what looked like Conor knocking Malignaggi down. There was basically a discussion of whether it was a push, whether it was a punch. all these different types of things. It resulted in Malignaggi being essentially leaving the McGregor camp, which is kind of interesting considering he was going to be part of the Showtime broadcast. But it was everyone just had this this opinion on, was this a punch? Was this a shove? This whole controversy there. And really everyone had a take on this fight. And kind of going through all the headlines, I mean, every celebrity that was into fighting at all was asked about this. And you basically kind of just see everyone's like, oh, yo, McGregor does this, he's got a chance. If McGregor does this, he's got a chance. And everyone was essentially taking a side, had a take, and basically giving credence to this fight, which everyone kind of knew in the fight game. Everyone kind of knew going into this that it would be a miracle if McGregor was to actually win. Obviously, the issues surrounding the race discussion, that was big going into this itself. Everything was spectacle. McGregor, they did an open workout. He was mocked because of how he was doing the movement. If you remember, kind of doing the arms back and forth.
Yeah, of course.
That was just kind of
Dixon Gracie.
Yeah, yeah. So that was, I mean, boxers were mocking him. He had to kind of defend himself against that. When they did the grand entrances or whatever they call this in boxing, which the guys show up, or it might have been either fight day or that weekend. I think actually it was that weekend. McGregor and Malignaggi getting into each other's face outside, and security really not knowing who Malignaggi was, and that was a whole thing. You then get to the fight itself. The weigh-ins were what they were. It was just kind of just all typical buzz. We get to the fight night itself. Fight Pass crashes. The Showtime app crashed as well. Anyone trying to buy online and people trying to buy through their cable providers could not actually either buy the event or actually, in most cases, watch the show because they were having issues with that. They actually had to, and I've never heard of this before, and I guess it's happened, they had to delay the main event to help everyone kind of like get set up to A, take orders, and then B, I think Xfinity actually had to reboot their entire servers in order to make sure that people could watch this fight. This is just insane, all this stuff leading into it. And then the fight happened itself, and Floyd won via 10th round TKO in a fight that was, I don't want to say more competitive, because I obviously Mayweather was on his game and knew what he was doing and never really got a sense that he was in trouble. I would say it was more entertaining and less where Mayweather and Pacquiao failed in terms of keeping fan interest in that feeling afterwards of, was my $100 worth it? Mayweather McGregor, I think, eclipsed that without a doubt. And I think it gave fans a feeling of satisfaction afterwards that the spectacle and everything up leading up to it was worth it. And then we got to, we got to the fight, the 10th round TKO happened. And then, everyone's kind of like, all right, we're ready to kind of move on with what's next in this giant sport spectacle. It did $600 million that night in revenue, just a tremendous amount of money, pay-per-view record set all over the world, number two pay-per-view here in the States, but number one, if you believe Dana White, who keeps throwing out the 6.7 number. This was just, it was as much as I was kind of like a little shop worn out leading up to it, it was a fun event. I was glad that in the end that it happened, but I was happy to move on from it. It was something I don't know. I don't think we'll ever see anything like this again. So it was fun while it lasted.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. The whole lead up to it was great. The Pauly Malignaggi thing, that added a layer to me, because honestly, had someone just asked me, could Conor McGregor beat Pauly Malignaggi in a boxing match? No way. Pauly's a former world champion. He's fought some great guys, and Conor has never boxed before. But it's right place, right time. I mean, you get the guy coming off a flight. You get him to spar literally that day, coming off a flight. That doesn't often happen with sparring partners. And sparring partners, you bring them in like half a dozen guys, and each guy's giving you three or four rounds. They got Pauly fresh off a flight to go 12 rounds. And in those 12 rounds, whether it was a knockdown or a slip, none of that mattered to me. What mattered to me is Pauly himself, who's a very honest individual, went on record and said, I got really tired, and he definitely won most of those rounds. And that meant a lot to me, because even though it was him not in shape, getting off a plane, he's a runner, first of all, you know what I mean? Like, Pauly's always in shape. I mean, he goes for long runs every morning. He eats an extremely tight diet, and he's a former world champion. His jab is fantastic. His evading skills are fantastic. He's very fast. So the fact that Conor could beat a guy like that, even though it was sparring, the fact that a guy, he's toying with him and he's playing with him, and everyone in attendance is saying, wow, Conor's really on, that made it more interesting to me that maybe, perhaps, this could be a fun fight for three or four rounds, that Conor's going to go out there, he's going to try to bull rush Floyd, he's going to try to land some big shots,
nobody really lands big shots on Floyd, but, you know, he'll try to make it greasy, he'll try to make it dirty, and then he'll probably fatigue, and Floyd's able to kind of take it in his domain and win the fight outright. But I think you nailed him. You said whether it was as competitive as people thought, whether all that stuff, it was entertaining, and it was worth it. And I had a party, and basically there was two parties going on. I felt bad about this, but I had a big party, and my brother had a big party, and we're like 20 minutes down the road from each other.
Oh, competition. I like it.
I know, but get this. He says at his place, he says, we're ordering it online. And I did not trust that because a fight of this magnitude is going to have so much traffic that what? Someone bumps the router and it goes out and you lose the fight? Like, I'm not taking that chance. I'm buying this thing on pay-per-view. I'm watching this thing on TV. So I told him right off the bat, I was like, listen, man, because he doesn't even have cable at his place. He only does everything off the internet. Like, I can't do that, man. So he's like, okay, well, I'm having a party. I had a party. He felt like Kane and the Undertaker. Of course, I'm Kane because my own father, Paul Bear, he attended my party. Felt bad about that too. But it was magical. Like, it was honestly, it was an awesome, awesome time. I also had a party for Mayweather Pacquiao, and it was well attended. But like 4 or 5 rounds into it, people are going outside for smoke. People are going to get a drink. And like, it didn't really matter. It didn't really captivate the audience. This fight, everybody sat there the entire time. Everybody was transfixed on it. Everybody's debating, did Conor win the first 4 rounds? Which later on the judge's scorecard, he won a round. But you're debating, how close was that round? Well, how do you have that round? Well, you know, Conor landed the big shot. It was super entertaining. It was interesting. It had everybody's intrigue. I thought it definitely delivered on the entertainment side of things. I think it delivered on the intrigue side of things. But if they have that fight 10 times, Floyd beats them 10 times. And that's just the fact of the matter, right? So I know there's a lot of Conor McGregor fans. I know there's a lot of people that are saying, oh, you know, he did this and that. The one thing I will give him, and I will absolutely give him this, even though I think he loses 10 times if he fights Floyd 10 times, Conor did way better in a boxing match than Floyd would do in an MMA match. And that's just fact. I mean, he was fighting him in his own backyard, fighting him in his own style, his rule set, the gloves that he's accustomed to. All these things were in Floyd's favor. If Floyd ever wanted to step into a cage, do you think it would last 10 rounds? Do you think it would last a minute? No, it would look like Randy Couture versus James Toney. It would absolutely. Even if Conor had a gentleman's agreement that I will not take you down, but I will kick you, he would take one kick to the body. He would fold over. I just think that's fact. If he wants to try to do that Philly shell defense and slick back, need the kick in the head, by all means, he would get killed. So in that regard, Conor fought the greatest fighter of all time. He landed more punches on the greatest fighter of all time than anybody else had pretty much ever done. I mean, you think about with Floyd Mayweather. Just look at the recent resume. Andre Berto, world champion. Pacquiao, world champion. Madonna, Saul Canelo Alvarez, Roberto Guerrero, Miguel Cotto, Victor Ortiz, Shane Mosley, Juan Manuel Marquez, Ricky Hatton. They're all world champions. They're all some of the greatest boxers of their generation, except for Victor Ortiz. He's terrible. But those guys were unbelievable, and Conor stepped into that, you know, arena to box him and didn't do all that bad, all things considered. People will say, oh, he toyed with them. Maybe he did. Maybe he did. It went 10 rounds. And Conor landed shots, and a couple of them were pretty decent. And I love how they allowed him to kind of clinch up as well. I mean, Robert Byrd was the referee, and I think a lot of the talk going in was, were they going to allow the clinch fighting? And whenever Conor would kind of clinch up with him and beat him up in the clinch, they allowed it to happen. And that was exciting to me. That was how he had a chance of winning this fight, you know. Floyd turns his back at one point. He says it was a low blow, and it probably was. Yeah. He turns his back, and Conor bombs on him like, it did a good job of just keeping the intrigue up. And then finally, I had a lot of money on Floyd. So getting the by TKO. So it ends in the 10th. The whole party's elated. I'm elated. Everybody's happy. It was a success. The $100, worth it. I'd do it again. You know, it was an awesome time. It was an awesome fight. And I think on the grand scheme of things, the UFC had a down year, but the UFC also had a hand in the pie in this fight. And this fight was such a rousing success that all in all, 2017 was a profitable year for the company.
Yep. Yeah. When Dana says that it was their best year ever, there's no doubt that this fight contributed to that. On the flip side, July and August was really dominated by Mayweather, McGregor, and John Jones. In August, we found out that John Jones failed his in-competition USADA drug test for Tarinabol. At that point that we found out, it was kind of like a WTF moment, but also like it didn't seem like that big of a surprise. It felt it was disappointing, but it wasn't like, I can't believe this happened. It was more like, I can't believe this happened again. What made it worse was this happened during Mayweather-McGregor fight week. So that was kind of a nice little jab at the sport of MMA during this big week. We learned that Dana White said he was considering a Stipe Miocic fight for 218. And at that point, Jones was, and probably should not have been, he was not stripped of the title at this point because obviously there was due process and trying to figure out what was happening. They had to test the B sample. But at this point, you know, and we talked about a little bit in talking through July, this was just it was not surprising, but it was also incredibly disappointing because of all the reasons we just talked about, is because that optimism that we had in July after that victory, the call-outs of Brock Lesnar, the possibilities for a Gustafson rematch, and just that the fact that a guy who is one of the best ever, if not the best ever, was going to be plying his trade again at least a couple more times a year, could be on the shelf for years and years and years due to another violation. And I mean, I can't imagine what obviously Daniel Cormier was thinking during this time. Obviously, he was devastated after the defeat. But to have that defeat chalked up to a guy that was cheating again, it just must be really tough for him to deal with. And obviously, we'll see him in the cage in just over a week's time at UFC 220 defending that title that he got back. But this was, it was, again, not surprising, but it was very disappointing when that news came out.
Yeah, 100%. To be honest with you, and I'm not the biggest Daniel Cormier fan, but he stole the legacy away from Daniel Cormier. Cormier is a former Olympian. He's a former Strike Force champion. He won the Grand Prix over there. He came to the UFC. He's had a near perfect career. There's basically been very few fights that you could even be deemed competitive for him. Yes, his fight with Alexander Gustafsson was actually a really fun fight. And then he loses that fight to John Jones. That's the one dark spot on his professional fighting career, is that he had lost to John Jones. So now he has this rematch opportunity. He's getting a little bit older. He's got an awesome Fox gig. He's actually a fantastic commentator. He's probably getting ready to sail off in the sunset. I can't imagine he needs the money. As I mentioned, you know, cutting down to 205 is probably difficult on his body, and he is getting a little bit older. Beat John Jones here, and there's nothing left to accomplish in your career. You've won the title. You won multiple world titles. You defeated the pound-for-pound greatest fighter that's probably, in my opinion, ever fought in MMA. This is the big one. This is, you go out and you can beat John Jones. You can make it all happen. Now, where it gets iffy here is that he won the first two rounds against John Jones. He was giving it to John Jones. And then John Jones knocks him out in the third. John Jones tests positive for Turinabol. And Turinabol was an Eastern European drug that was most famously used at the Olympics. It gives you that extra juice. It gives you those extra miles. So who's to say? Because that's a frantic pace for the first two rounds. Cormier is going forward. In the third round, Cormier is tired, and John Jones looks like he just got out of bed. He's completely fresh. Imagine John Jones is clean and didn't have any Turinabol in his system. It's completely plausible to imagine that he would be a little tired, too, from that trepid pace of the first two rounds. Both men are tired. You don't just start beating him. Because you look at that third round, it's one man who's clearly getting fatigued and one man who's very, very fresh, starts putting on him, starts to find his range, starts landing the kicks, goes upstairs, knocks him out. Without the drugs, that is a completely different fight. If Daniel Cormier was able to accomplish that fight, I don't even think this Usdemir fight would be happening right now. Because you don't go from beating John Jones, becoming the greatest fighter that's ever fought in light heavyweight, being talked about as one of the pound-for-pound greats of all time. Think about it. Daniel Cormier was a heavyweight Grand Prix winner in Strikeforce. And now he's coming to 205, accomplishes all this stuff. You don't go from the highest part of the mountain to fighting Volkan Uzdemir. What happens is you get KO'd. First time you've ever been knocked out. Now he's got a sour taste in his mouth. He doesn't want to end his career having been knocked out. So now he's taking this Volkan Uzdemir fight so he can right the ship a little bit. It's not a sexy fight. It's not an appealing fight. The moment for him was to go out there and beat John Jones. And if John was clean, there was an infinite possibility that maybe Daniel Cormier would have accomplished that dream and that goal and his aspiration and all the things that he'd been building towards, and the grudge against John Jones. All these things would have came to fruition for him, but he was robbed of that. And I will always feel bad for him because of that, because that was his moment. And John tested positive for Turinabol, which I'm very familiar with. It is most definitely a performance enhancer. People will say it's a cheap oral steroid. It was in his system. He took it. And by the way, John Jones is a guy that has a dirty rap sheet. whether you believe the stories of him hiding from USADA under a Greg Jackson, Mike Winklejohn ring at the gym just to avoid it, whether you believe the fact that he's already tested positive before, he tested positive for estrogen blockers, which means that he's doing steroids and then taking a completely different substance to try to mask what else is in his system. The man is a cheater. He is a cheater. But pound for pound, he's a hell of a fighter. You know what I mean? So I do give him the credit where credit's due. I believe he is the greatest American fighter, probably the greatest pound for pound fighter. But if you're going to throw the steroid argument into there, maybe he's not as great as we thought he was. Maybe Demetrius Johnson really is a better pound for pound fighter. Maybe Daniel Cormier really was the better man, but we'll never know. He robbed him from that. So that to me was a huge story. I mean, it dominated headlines, and it was one of those things where people, like you said, people weren't surprised. Nobody was, oh my God, John Jones tested positive again. People were more just like disappointed, like, oh my God, John Jones tested positive again. It's like when Chael Sonnen fails. Nobody's surprised, but it's almost like, ah, dude, again, really? Like, you knew they were going to test you. You knew this was going to happen. How'd you fail again? But you do, and it's embarrassing. And that's exactly how I felt for John Jones. I was embarrassed for him.
Let's go through the rest of the month. And again, no events to speak of, but just really kind of some news and leading up to the last few months of the year. Dana White and Tyron Woodley talked it out, so apparently they made some peace after some issues in July. White said also that Ronda Rousey, something we kind of had thought was already kind of a given, but that she was probably going to retire, get married, have kids, and be out of the spotlight. We still have heard no official announcement yet, but that was Dana White's assertion when he was asked that during fight week. Let's see, what else? Zuffa Boxing became a thing. Dana White's wearing a Zuffa Boxing t-shirt and was asked about it, I believe, by Luke Thomas and some other people, and he didn't exactly turn it down, as we know now that White wants to do some boxing promotion. And we also found out, interestingly enough, that Ari Emanuel was interested in buying the Top Rank fight library. So it was kind of intriguing that they are looking to get more into the content business, perhaps acquire that library, put it on Fight Pass, make that the fuel for a Zuffa Boxing promotion to do another OTT service or something like that. So something to kind of watch for the future there. Actually, we did have one event, UFC Mexico City. We had Sergio Pettis beating Brandon Moreno. A fight result I never thought I'd see. Sam Alvey defeating Rashad Evans, out of all people. And also Nico Price and Alexa Grassi picking up some wins on that show as well. UFC 216, we had Paige VanZant returning to action, scheduled to fight Jessica Ai. Ally Quinta said he was not thrilled with Snoop Dogg's commentary on the Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series. Chris Cyborg saying she wanted Holly Holm for her first title defense, and a little bit of foreshadowing. Michael Bisping revealed that he was, when he was on vacation to Hawaii, his family was robbed twice, and that he almost drowned. So that was a fun summer vacation for Michael Bisping. UFC Shanghai got Anderson Silva versus Kelvin Gastelum as a main event for a Fight Pass show. GSP decided or announced he was he had signed the Michael Bisping deal to set to fight at UFC 217. So that show actually rounded out quite a bit during the month of August. We got obviously the GSP Bisping main event. Cody versus TJ Dillashaw was announced as a co-main event. Stephen Thompson, Jorge Masvidal was announced, and also a few other smaller fights as that card really started to develop. UFC Norfolk has really turned out to be a fun show. One of those shows I was thinking about trying to get to. A bunch of veterans on this show. We had Anthony Pettis versus Dustin Poirier signed as the main event. Matt Brown versus Diego Sanchez returning to welterweight signed for that show as well. Joe Lozon versus Clay Guida, and then John Dodson versus Mahmoud Moraes. Frank Mir, we signed with Bellator after being released from UFC the month before. We got a UFC interim lightweight title fight announced for UFC 216 as Tony Ferguson and Kevin Lee would do battle for that crown, not Khabib Nurmagomedov. UFC Sao Paulo, we got the return, the announced return of Lyoto Machida coming back to fight against Derek Brunson in the main event. Colby Covington versus Damian Maia in the co-main event for that. Bellator 186 got Ryan Bader versus a Linton Vassell light heavyweight title fight. Bigfoot Silva decided he was going to start going into kickboxing and got his first glory kickboxing fight signed against none other than Rico Verhoeven. JDS, Junior Dos Santos, unfortunately flagged by USADA. He was out of his UFC 215 fight against Francis Ngannou. Brian Stan announced he was going to be leaving the UFC commentary booth to go into real estate and also some other side businesses. And a very good story. Matt Hughes was announced. It was said that Matt Hughes is starting to grapple against, obviously, after his near tragic accident, getting hit by a train. Looked like he was on the mend, and that's good to hear. Derek Lewis, really good feel good story, helping out the people of Houston after Hurricane Harvey just devastated that city. Dana White Contender Series wrapped up with 17 fighters signed to UFC contracts. And the aforementioned Ronda Rousey married to Travis Brown, breaking the hearts of fight fans around the world. So that was the rest of August. Anything from that stand out to you?
Yeah, well, a couple things. The Dana White comment about Ronda Rousey being retired, which I think everybody already knew. As we talked about a little bit in the show already, Josh, whenever Dana White says something not happening, or Michael Bisping's definitely going to fight the winner of Whitaker Romero. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Dana White also went on record to say that George St. Pierre definitely did not want to fight again and would not be coming out of retirement, but he did. And, you know, you can look at it. Dana White, Nunez is never going to headline the card again. Her next fight headlines the card. Now she's getting ready to, if she does fight Cyborg, it'll headline the card.
Yeah.
In the past, he said that the UFC is not for sale, will never sell, then it sells. Tito Ortiz is not welcome to ever come back, then he's back. If he says something, in all honesty, he could probably go the other way. And the thing with Ronda Rousey is I think she's retired. I don't think she wants to fight. But this is MMA. This is the sporting world. In a perfect world, she goes to wrestling, and she's going to realize it's a lot harder than she probably thinks it's going to be. But all the same, she goes to wrestling. She could team up with Shayna Baszler. I don't know if Jessamyn Duke or Marina Shafir plan on getting into it. I don't know. I can't imagine that they're going to be good wrestlers. But let's say she goes to the WWE. She can do a little bit of fun there. Misha Tate is just announced her pregnancy with Johnny Nunez, former tough competitor. She's going to have a kid. She's sidelined. She's retired. Leslie's going to do a little bit of wrestling. She's sidelined. She's retired. In 2-3 years, Josh, don't you think that people are still going to want to see that fight? Put Tate versus Rousey again for the third time around? Does Rousey still got it? Can she take a punch? Whoa, Misha Tate, she won the title after Rousey went away. Rousey doesn't got it anymore. Oh, Tate's been getting better. She's still full-time at Extreme Couture. Ooh, like, you can always sell it. When you've got two big-name fighters and you've got a star such as Ronda Rousey, who's going to go on the Ellen Show, and she's going to go on Dancing with the Stars, and, you know, the casual person is going to know who she is. You can always sell it. So when Dana says that, I don't fully believe it. Then over to the Zuffa boxing, I think that one's super interesting because to me what it is that if you are WMG and you come in here and you buy the UFC for the amount of money that they purchased it for, $4 billion, they were really relying on the fact that this TV deal is coming up and we're going to be able to get more money out of it. But they went and they told their investors something crazy like, we're going to get twice as much money. Fox has already given them a fair chunk of change. So how are you going to double that? Well, what you do is you start a boxing promotion. So like you're saying, go out and acquire the top rank library. But I don't think that's necessarily just to slot on Fight Pass. Yes, you can most definitely do that. But you get the library, you get additional programming out of it. You can make packaging, you can make best ups, you can do all those things. Now you have a boxing promotion. Now when you go to a TV company, whether you go to an ESPN, whether you go to an online platform like an Amazon or a Netflix or whatever it may be, you're not just selling the UFC. You're selling, well, we have the UFC and we have Zuffa Boxing and we have all these libraries and we have all these shows and we have all these all access specials from the past. Now you're doubling down on the amount of programming, you're doubling down on the amount of content, and you could potentially double down on the amount of dollars that are coming back. And that's kind of how they would double up their money. So I think that one's super interesting. The UFC could definitely do a lot of positive things for boxing because they have such a strong brand, such a strong name that perhaps if they could, you know, give a little bit of spotlight to some of these fighters. But the UFC business model of giving the fighters such a small share, it's not going to work. You're not going to go over there and get Danny Garcia and Errol Spence Jr. and Gennady Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez. Like they demand too much money that the UFC is not willing to pay for them. Could they get a bunch of B or A-minus level fighters? Yeah, absolutely. Could they help build the careers of young aspiring Olympians? Yeah, absolutely. But those big megastars, I just don't really think it fits the mold. And finally, devastating for me, Sugar Rashad Evans. I knew he was going to lose to Sam Alvey, and I say that because he was coming off a loss to Dan Kelly. And at this point, I think we all need to realize that Rashad Evans is certainly not the man he used to be. I'm quick to point out that a lot of the times, these aging veterans, and we've seen the same thing happen with Gilbert Melendez, you're not having the same success that you had in prior times, so you decide, I need to drop down a weight class. But you don't realize that you're in your mid-30s and your body's not going to react positively to it. Rashad Evans going down to 185 was disastrous. He fought twice. He he lost both times and he looked absolutely terrible. And now he goes on record saying, I can't do it. Remember when we saw Gilbert Melendez go down to 45 against Jeremy Stephens? He looked absolutely awful. He lost. Diego Sanchez, when he tried to go to 45 against Lamas, it just, it makes no sense. You can't all of a sudden realize I'm in my mid 30s and I'm on the losing streak. I'm just going to drop down a weight class and make all things better. It's 2018 now, but even 2017, we're not far removed. Science is a real thing, and we realize the science of cutting weight, and it's bad. Why would you want to cut an extra 10 pounds of weight out of your body and think that that's going to be the magical solution to fight some young up-and-comer who's got 10 years on you in the age department and is going to be naturally quicker and is going to be naturally more youthful? So I just feel like it was a tough situation for Rashad, and now he's coming back yet again, but he's doing it at 205 because he realizes I can't make 185. Even Thiago Alves tried to make 155. It blew up in his face. He missed weight by 7 pounds and got beat up by Jim Miller. You can't do that. It's not the magical solution that it might have been back in the mid-2000s. You got to take your body seriously. You got to fight that away class that's most appropriate to you.
And I think we saw a lot of that throughout 2017. I think probably more in 2018 as guys and girls try to fight in a weight class that's better for them. Let's go to September. And what we'll do, September was a really kind of, I want to say, flat month. There was events and shows, but it was kind of like after how big Mayweather-McGregor was and really the summer was, it was kind of a transition to the last quarter of the year. So I kind of broke these headlines up into three sections. So I'll run through these, and I'll ask you for any quick hit thoughts on these. So we start September, UFC 215. It was supposed to be Demetrius Johnson against Ray Borg, headlining that show as Demetrius Johnson continued to chase history with his flyweight title defenses, really title defenses in general. However, Ray Borg had to pull out of that fight due to illness. Did not immediately say it was due to weight cutting, but everyone kind of figured out what was going on later on. He had to pull out of that fight. So Amanda Nunes, the women's featherweight champion who had never headlined another show, as you alluded to, headlined this show, edging out Valentina Shevchenko again in their rematch to retain the title. Jeremy Stephens, you mentioned him before in talking about Gilbert Melendez. Jeremy Stephens dominating Gilbert Melendez at featherweight to open up this show. Really, Melendez had been off for obviously a year due to, I believe it was marijuana, and he had been out for quite some time. Henry Cejudo, really looking fantastic, kind of a new karate-esque style stance. TKOing Wilson Hayes. RDA looking fantastic, talking about guys going up in weight, fighting 170 pounds, submitting Neil Magny, looking fantastic doing it. And we learned that Ray Borg versus DJ was going to be rescheduled for UFC 216 in October. UFC Rotterdam, this was the first event following Mayweather-McGregor. We had Alexander Volkov TKOing Stefan Struve in round three of their fight. Sayre the Great, but Sayre Bahadurzadeh returning back with a big knockout victory, looking a little bit sluggish early on, but coming through with a big knockout at UFC Rotterdam. Ben Askren, remember him? Continued to win in one fighting championship and picking up another victory over there, and it was announced he was going to be retiring in November, and his final retirement or his final fight scheduled for November against where did I just put this? Chinyaoki. Yeah, that's right. So Ben Askren said he would come back for quote unquote big fights, but obviously Dana White not a big fan of his. WWE did a backstage angle with Ronda Rousey and the Four Horsewomen. So that was quite a bit of bad acting for those that saw that. CM Punk, there was a question mark about him potentially returning. Duke Rufus put out an Instagram post, I believe, basically saying they were just waiting for the signing of a fight contract. As we sit here on January 12th, that contract has not been signed, so we have no idea what's going on and if CM Punk will ever return to the Octagon. UFC announced they were changing up their Reebok uniform slightly, adding in new colors and also adding in what they called the Legacy Series, which was dedicated to main eventers and I believe co-main eventers of some big events, with kind of doing their own custom shirts and didn't really end up in a lot of new money for anyone yet, but it was just something they were doing a little bit differently. Cyborg Justino decided she was going to get a boxing license in California as she waited for her next fight. Still is not boxed, but again, this infatuation with MMA fighters and boxing continued throughout 2017. Donald Cerrone versus Darren Till was booked for the UFC Dansk main event. The Vertitas sold their final UFC piece of the pie to WMEIMG, effectively ending their relationship with UFC. And Roy McDonald accusing Robbie Lawler of PED use, and then his fight with Douglas Lima was officially announced for January in Los Angeles, California. So I have that first section. What stood out to you the most?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, Watts always stands out, but the Cyborg situation with her applying for the boxing license, I mean, yeah, I think you nailed it when you said that there's been that infatuation with a lot of MMA fighters that are now thinking to themselves, well, if I can get a good payday and I can go out there and do what, you know, seems to be an easier sport on my body, then why not do that? We heard Stipe Miocic go on record and try to get a fight with Anthony Joshua, which makes no sense to me, but all the same, you know, angling for kind of, well, the heavyweight champ in boxing versus the heavyweight champ in MMA. You have, obviously, Conor McGregor with that Floyd Mayweather fight kind of open up those ideas. His former training partner, I guess current training partner, Artem Lobov, talking about how he would fight Pauly Malignaggi. And then you have Cyborg. Cyborg coming out and saying, well, I would like to box. And she spent a lot of time boxing with former two-time Olympic gold medalist Clarissa Shields, who's pound for pound the greatest woman boxer I've seen in a very, very, very long time. Super humble girl. And big things are going to be coming out of her. She's fighting in the Showbox edition of on Showtime on Friday night. So I don't know when this airs, but it is actually tonight. But people got to realize that, you know, you can't just jump into another sport and have that immediate success. She tried doing Muay Thai kickboxing in a lion fight out of Las Vegas, and she was successful in her first fight. But in her second fight, she took on Yorina Barros, who is, again, one of the best Muay Thai fighters that is that competes currently in the women's featherweight division. And Yorina Barros dropped her and put a beating on her. So I think it's better suited for you're an MMA fighter. Your skills involve around beating people up, wearing 4-ounce gloves, being able to clinch up, being able to use the cage work. You are a BJJ black belt. You can get the fight to the ground. It's not as easy as just thinking, well, I know how to throw two punches. Something that's very interesting is Chris Lytle. Everybody's favorite Chris Lytle. Love me some Chris Lytle. Retires from MMA, decides that he wants to run for Senate in Indiana. That obviously never comes to fruition. Now he's just kind of hanging out, getting a little bit older, obviously. No imminent return to the MMA world. He accepted a bare-knuckle boxing event going down in England also this weekend, where he's taking on a gypsy traveling fighter. Melvin Gillard, also on the card, has fought down there a number of times, as have a couple UFC veterans, and as well as Bellator veteran and one-time Bobby Lashley foe, Josh Burns. So, I mean, these guys, they want to fight. They are athletes. They are fighters deep down. They want to go out there and compete, but you have to compete in the realm that's best suited towards your skill set. Don't just go out there for that payday and get beat up. And the second thing I want to touch on is, I know obviously maybe a lot of fans of the show, because you're looking at what's popular, and obviously the McGregor stories are popular and the Rousey stories are popular, and people might not watch Bellator, and they certainly might not watch ONE FC, but Ben Askren is the man. This guy is, in my opinion, second to none. He could have came in the UFC and he could have been a world champion. He could have been a world champion in any organization that he chose to compete in. The argument is always that, wow, he's just a boring wrestler. First of all, how many boring wrestlers are in the UFC right now? Think about this for a moment, right? Tyron Woodley is the champion, and yes, he's got the big right hand, but for the most part, people just keep saying, well, how boring he is, and he is a wrestler. Okay, well, who are some of the top contenders? Well, we got, Colby Covington. Well, he's just a boring wrestler, though, isn't he? And what about Kamaru Usman? Well, he's just a boring wrestler. Those guys dominate. Because wrestling is the dominating art. Brock Lesnar versus Mark Hunt wasn't exactly a very thrilling fight, but it was a domination. It was, I'm going to take you down and ride you like a miniature pony. And that's what Ben Askren's always done. But furthermore, he's not just a boring wrestler. If you look at his performances, he smashed Andre Korshkov. He smashed Douglas Lima. He went to ONE FC, and I mean, these guys can't even go the distance with him because he's such a class above them that he's killing them. Shinya Aoki, and I get that he, you know, is a natural 155-pounder, he got killed. He basically was tapping out before the ref jumped in to stop it because he didn't have a chance. You can't submit Ben Askren. He's such a good grappler. He's been spending so much time at Duke Rufus's camp that technically on his feet, he's savvy enough to not get knocked out long enough to take you down. Khabib's not a great striker. He's not a bad striker. Don't get me wrong. But Khabib just knows how to corner you, cut the angle off, get a hold of you, take you to the ground, and basically steal the soul from your body. And that's what Ben Askren does. If he wants the takedown, he's going to get it. You might stop the first two, but he's a chain wrestler. He'll keep shooting takedowns until he gets them on you. His cardio is fantastic. Funky Ben is a world-class guy. And he retires from ONE FC because it's almost a joke at this point. You're getting ready to fight guys you've never heard of, and you're beating them in a minute or two. It's not even worth it to him anymore. I might as well just run my Askren Wrestling Academy out of Milwaukee and, you know, do private seminars. I can do all that stuff. I can make money. I don't have to fly to Singapore and fight guys. But he wants to fight in the UFC. Give him George St. Pierre. I don't know the whole Tyron Woodley thing because they do train together a little bit at Duke Rufus's, but he's a competitor. He'll fight anybody. If you offered him that fight, he would take it. Tyrone would have a problem with it, but Ben Askren wouldn't. Give him Woodley. Give him George St. Pierre. Give him Colby. Everybody hates Colby Covington. Bring Askren in. Colby Covington takes everybody down. Let's see him take down Ben Askren. Let me see that. You can have this guy come in here. You can have storylines. He's undefeated. He has an immaculate looking record. He talks a pretty good game. He's good on social media. People like the guy. Why would you not give him his chance? That's honestly a big letdown for me.
I would agree. Yeah, it's a shame if he never does, and never say never, but it'd be a shame if he never gets a chance to ply his trade in the UFC. That would be unfortunate.
You know what would be a shame too, Josh? What would be a shame is that I believe he's like 33 years old right now. It's a shame when some of these guys get their chance and they're 35 and they're 36 and you don't get to see the best of them. I mean, the prime of an athlete's career goes by very quickly. And if you look at the top, if you take the top 15 fighters in, because the UFC has obviously their rankings and they rank the top 15. If you take every single fighter there, their age, and you took an average, the average is 30-31. And that's the average prime of a top 15 fighter. That's not to say that a Damian Maia can't be 39 years old and be ranked in the top five. That's not to say that a champion like Daniel Cormier can't be into his mid to late 30s. That's just an average. The average top 15 contender is between the ages of 30 and 31. And with Ben Askren at 33 years old, you've got to think that the prime of his career was probably the last couple of years, and they still haven't signed him. And like you said, never say never. I would love to see him compete in the UFC, but at some point you got to realize that you're not getting the best version. And that's what hurts, you know. Now he could be like a Tyron Woodley, who's, because he's a good wrestler and he hasn't taken much wear and tear, he's an older fighter as well, who's still competing at the highest level. George St. Pierre come off this huge long layoff and perhaps look better than ever. Now, you know, he did fatigue a little bit, but he's up a weight class with all that ring rust. I'd say that was one of George's best performances. Maybe Ben Askren could do that, but it is a shame to, if he doesn't get his shot, but it'll also be a shame if he gets his shot in 2 years from now, while he's not the same fighter, he loses, and then they say, oh, there you go. Do you remember, you might not, but do you remember a fighter named Antonio McKee?
Yes.
His kid, AJ McKee, is a standout for Bellator right now. Antonio McKee was a fantastic wrestler. His losses were only the top guys. Like at the time, Jason Black was the top guy. Carl Parisian was the top guy. Those were his losses. Besides that, he was on like a 10 or 15 fight winning streak. He would routinely go on record to say, I would smash BJ Penn. Give me BJ Penn. I would smash BJ Penn, who was the current UFC lightweight champ at that time. Antonio McKee was a lightweight fighter. He competed for the MFC organization out of Canada, of all places, because he was finding it hard to get fights in America. The UFC signed Antonio McKee. He was past his prime when they signed him. They gave him one single fight. He fought Jacob Volkman, who is a like-minded, pretty one-dimensional wrestler. I thought he won that fight, but all the same, he lost a split decision, and they cut him, and they made a mockery out of him. Oh, you thought you could beat BJ. You can't even beat Jacob Volkman. Oh, you said you could beat guys in the UFC. We gave you your chance, and you failed. It was almost like, let's bring this guy in to lose, and then we can ridicule him about all that stuff he said about us. Ben Askren said a lot of stuff about Dana White. If they're waiting this guy out until he's older so that they can bring him into the UFC and have him fight a terrible stylistical matchup for him, you know, it would be a real big shame. But all the same, this is business, and you can't talk about crap about the president of a company and then expect them to give you a nice lucrative deal out of it. So it's tough, but I am a big Ben Askren fan, so that's always been a situation that's kind of irked me a little bit.
Let's rip through the last part of the month then. John Jones' B sample failed. It was confirmed that he had failed those tests. The fight against Daniel Cormier was made no contest. He was stripped of the title. It was returned to Daniel Cormier, and a lot of people are kind of wondering why that was. Well, that's kind of the protocol. That's what happened. So, fortunately, Daniel Cormier becomes the light heavyweight champion again, technically, or never lost a title, but just the way that went about was kind of just a weird thing. We talked about that a lot. UFC Pittsburgh results, Luke Rockhold returning after a long layoff to overcome David Branch in his return fight, tapping out Branch due to strikes after kind of looking kind of weak on, not weak, but struggling on the fight, on the feet a little bit early on, but overcoming David Branch and reclaiming his position at 185 pounds. Mike Perry knocking out Alex Reyes. Alex Reyes, a short last-minute replacement for Thiago Alves, who was stuck in Florida due to all the hurricanes and the issues down there. Mayweather-McGregor, we started to get a little bit of financial news out of that. It broke the UK pay-per-view records with more than 1 million buys. The early reports were 4.4 million buys. It was projected around 4.6. So there's going to be a lot of questions, and we have to wait a couple months to see where those pay-per-view buys are going to end up. Joanna Jędrzejczyk versus Rose Namajunas was signed for UFC 217, helping round out that card. Nick Newell, former World Series of Fighting phenom, obviously fighting with one arm, and really just kind of known for a really interesting and inspirational story. Had retired, announced he was going to make his return for mixed martial arts for Legacy Fighting. Gabriel Gonzaga decided, again, boxing, said he was going to make his pro boxing debut. Mark Hunt admitted to slurring his words and stuttering a little bit at times. And those public words were actually going to make him get pulled from his next fight, which we'll talk about in our next episode. USADA rearing its ugly head again, flagging Jesse Taylor, the redemption story we talked about just a couple months earlier. He was flagged by USADA and then put on the shelf indefinitely. Carlos Condit, out of nowhere, said he was planning on returning to the UFC either in December or January. UFC announced they're going to debut in Fresno, California in December for a show there. Matt Brown said he was going to retire after the Diego Sanchez fight unless he was going to be able to make a title run. So it's always kind of that question of, you know, where do retirements actually really matter? UFC Japan, you actually talked about that a little bit earlier. Yushin Okami was announced a last minute fighter to fill in for Shogun Hua, who was injured going into this fight, announced a book to assign to fight OSP in the UFC Japan main event. That event actually happened in August or September rather. OSP just running through Yushin Okami again, the last second fighter, and submitting him on the ground, looking impressive doing so. Jessica Andrade beating Claudia Gadelha in what I thought was a fight of the year candidate. A real fun, bloody affair. You don't really see a lot in the women's division, and that was the co-main event on the show. Gokhan Saki, who you talked about earlier, picking up a big victory here. And then Takanori Gomi losing in what would be his final UFC performance, a guy that had a great run in Pride, a great run in Japan in general, and then was brought in the UFC with not great results. Someone that they signed, kind of talking about Ben Askren, someone they signed well after his prime, but he had a decent run, losing and pretty badly, and then getting cut after that. Bellator 183, one of their big tentpole shows. Patricky Pitbull edging out Benson Henderson via split decision. What seems to be the story of Benson Henderson's fighting life. Aaron Pico rebounding big after that MSG crushing defeat in his debut, coming up with a big victory and getting back on track. Paul Daly, nice campaign for him in 2017, knocking out Lorenz Larkin. And then Roy Nelson making his Bellator debut and decisioning Ayala in that fight as well. That was a pretty fun fight to watch. Paige Van Zandt was injured and had to be pulled from her UFC 216 fight against Jessica Ai. UFC 218, December, started to get some fights. Francis Ngannou booked against Alistair Overeem. Dominic Cruz against Jimmy Rivera in essentially a number one contender fight. Cynthia Calvillo against Carla Esparza. Henry Cejudo against Sergio Pettis. Verdum Ferguson and those guys, Fabricio Verdum, Tony Ferguson, trading some unfortunate words at a UFC luncheon out in California. Some gay slurs thrown around. Not a good year for Fabricio Verdum. We'll get into, obviously, the boomerang throwing later on, but it was not a good good year for Fabricio Verdum, really, in the cage. Or he picked up a victory, but just not good overall. And Frank Shamrock deciding announced he was going to be filling in for Dan Henderson against Sakuraba at that Rising Grappling bout we talked about earlier. So that wraps up September. What that last section stood out to you?
Yeah, well, when Frank Shamrock got announced against Sakuraba, I was like, oh, baby, yes, the gods are being delightful. But, you know, it ended up being a bit of a stinker. And I don't know what to expect with Sakuraba anymore. I mean, people got to realize that, first of all, his body's completely shattered from fighting. Then his body's furthermore shattered from pro wrestling. And then furthermore, his body is shattered from smoking two packs of cigarettes a day over the last 25 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know why I get excited. Like, I know it's going to happen, but part of me is like, oh, yes, Sakuraba's back. So, yeah, that one hurt. Takanori Gomi, I mean, he did exactly what I think people realized happens to Takanori Gomi at this point. If the fight stays standing, it might be exciting. The second it hits the ground, he's absolutely toast. And listen, there is no shame in losing to Dunyun Kim. But when you're losing to the other Dunyun Kim, you might have a problem on your hand. You talked briefly about Aaron Pico getting back to the win column. 100% prospect to watch out for in maybe all of MMA. I had to eat a lot of crow when he lost his debut because I was so high up on this kid. And we actually talked about it on the show. I love me some Aaron Pico. Well, the last time I came on. he's a phenomenal athlete. He's a young talent. He's a guy that goes to the gym regularly and beats guys that are, you know, the Josh Thompsons of the world, the savvy veterans of the world. He's one of the best wrestlers that's currently competing in MMA. And when you see the fact that he's a good striker as well, 2018 is going to be a breakout year for him. Flip side to that, we talk about some of these aging veterans. We obviously Gomi, you know, loses, cut from the UFC, but we see him come back at Ryzen, which he lost again. Surprise, surprise. But he ends up making that appearance yet again. You talk about Carlos Condit. He comes out of retirement. Matt Brown announces he's going to retire. Oh, wait, he won that fight. Now he doesn't want to retire anymore. Even Newell. Nick Newell, you mentioned one arm, actually just one hand. He uses that other arm quite effectively.
That's true. He's pretty effective with it.
Even he has the allure of coming back. Fighters are going to fight. These guys are always going to want to fight. They're always going to want to come back. And that's kind of the theme here, is that you might announce your retirement. You might be thinking this is the last one. Even this weekend, we got Vitor Belfort coming back. Not only has Vitor Belfort already announced a prior retirement and come back, he's now announcing another retirement following his fight with Uriah Hall. But wait, it gets even worse than that. He says, I'm retiring for sure this time. Unless a big money fight presents itself, like, you can always draw these guys back. There's always just one more fight to be had. I mean, if anybody thinks Tank Abbott's done fighting, there's always one more for everybody. It's just the way it is. Now, unfortunately, health issues do get in the way for some of these guys, but at 30, 40 years old, if we've seen Hoist Gracie fight Ken Shamrock in Bellator and people were actually interested in watching it, the sky's the limit. You can be 51 years old. That's the new 40. You know, at first it used to be, oh, you're 35, you're over the hill. Then it was, oh, you're 45, you're over the hill. Now you're going to see these guys fighting it. Even Ken Shamrock, a guy that's retired multiple times, is saying, I still got a couple fights in me. Dan Severn, who just recently had an episode of Where Are They Now, saying, there's a couple of guys I would come out of retirement to fight. You're a grandfather. You have six grandchildren. You're in your mid-50s, but the lure of one more, because I know it's a cliche saying here, Josh, but fighters fight. It's who they are, right? It's guys that when they were kids on the playground, they would go to a fight. For a lot of us, you know, Billy's going to fight you at 3 o'clock after school. You know, you get a bad gut feeling. You're like, oh my God, like I got to go out there. And some of these guys, they love it. They go out there. They don't care. I have a friend of mine who's currently living and training in China, and he's had like, and I'm sure this is not good for his health, but he's had like 9 fights this year, right? He's 25 years old, and in his entire fighting career, he's had some 45 fights. But he fights at a drop of a hat. You give him like an hour's notice and he doesn't know the opponent and the weight class is, he's given up 20 pounds. He just wants to fight. That's who he is. And eventually you have a family and you got to realize that you got to make money and you got to support them and you're not that young kid anymore. But for these guys, that one more paycheck, that one more, hey, you know what? You can make one more payday. And if it's a nice payday, they're always going to come back. And that's what I definitely saw with Condit coming back. He has not looked like the man he used to be. And there's no shame in that, because obviously he's not the man he used to be. But it's tough watching some of these aging legends, guys that you love to see go out there and lose to guys that are never going to be world title holders. They're never going to be world title contenders. You know, they're gatekeepers, they're journeymen. And that's no disrespect to a guy like, you know, Magny. I'm just saying Carlos Condit, for what he used to be, the natural born killer, he just isn't anymore. There's no shame in that. Matt Brown got lucky. Matt Brown is a guy that we all like watching fight. He's one of the most entertaining fighters to ever grace the octagon. But just like Mark Hunt's comments that you touched on, Matt Brown went on record to say that he can't remember things anymore. And he's starting to slur his speech and he realizes that the end is near. So he books a one last fight. And the one last fight, they give him, here's a freebie. You're a welterweight fighter. We're going to give you Diego Sanchez, who is also an aging shot fighter who has very little punching power, so you don't have to worry about being knocked out and having your brain rattled again. And not only that, but Diego Sanchez is going back up to 170 for the first time in 8 years, and you know what I mean? He's not a welterweight. This is a low-risk fight for you. Go out there and have some fun one last time. We're going to pat you on the back. You've been a company man, Matt Brown. We appreciate everything you've done for us. He goes and he kills Diego Sanchez. A beautiful elbow. What a great way to cap off a career. You know, a KO of the night. Thanks for the extra $50,000. Wave for the fans. Go spend some time with your kid. No, that feeling he got, that adrenaline rush that shot through his veins, he wants to come back. Now he says, well, I'm not really retired. Oh, I'd like to fight this guy. Come on, man. You know, you're never going to be able to leave. That's why there's an old saying in pro wrestling that I've always liked. It's better to go out on your back, you know, lose and then go out a loser. Don't win and then you sit at home and think, what if I could have won a couple more? Lose, right? Chael Sonnen the other day came out and said, when I leave this sport, I'll be face down and embarrassed. Man, I appreciate that. What a breath of fresh air. Get your ass kicked, and then you know it's over. Don't win. Oh, I beat Diego Sanchez. Maybe I still got a title run left. No, there's no title run left in it for you.
Right.
Do you really want to fight Mike Perry and Darren Till and Gunnar Nelson and Santiago Ponzinibbio? You really want to fight those guys? No, you don't want to fight those guys. Call it a day. You have a kid. Enjoy some time with him.
Yep, I would agree. Well, it's the lie between what fans want, the money you make, and then the thrill going out there, and then the reality that, yeah, physical harm is not good in the current time, and it's also not good down the road, and these guys are going to be in their 40s and 50s and be like, oh, I wish I didn't take that fight. But that's the way fighting goes, and obviously we'll be having the same discussion a year from now when we talk to you at the when the next year in review shows. Before we let you go, you've been very gracious with your time. 90 minutes so far is a bit. I told you guys it was a big quarter. What do you have to promote? Where can people check in with you and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so you can always give me a follow on Twitter at CJ Saftik. Love interacting with the fans. And if you have any questions or you want to talk about some old fights, as you can tell, I love talking any facet of MMA, but also I'm a big fan of boxing, a big fan of kickboxing. So if you like any type of combat sport, give me a reach over there, as well as obviously at Facebook from my name. I don't mind adding people as long as they want to, you know, talk some fights or talk anything combat sports related. You can always catch me at Fight Network, and as well as I do a show for DraftKings where we talk about a lot of the DraftKings pricing for upcoming events. I do that with Paul Shaughnessy, who is a great follow as well, at Paul Shag. And we do that for the Pat Mayo Experience at the PME. So, yeah, I mean, my days pretty much consist of two things, and that's watching fights and watching horse racing, which are two of the best sports, in my opinion. I do love them both very much so. But, yeah, I mean, I'm happy. Life's been going good. 2017 was a great year for me, and I just want to keep some of that momentum going into 2018. So starting it off with UFC in St. Louis, which I'm looking forward to. And yeah, keep the momentum going. I really appreciate you having me back on the show, Josh. I had an awesome time the last time we did it. And kind of at the back of my mind, I was kind of hoping like, oh, I hope I did a good enough job that, you know, maybe I'll get the call back. And I got the call back. So thank you very much. I do appreciate the platform. And 90 minutes flies right by, buddy.
Certainly does. And here's to a 2018 of all good movies, all good fights, and all good all the ponies coming in the winner's circle. How about that?
Wow, that sounds very good to me. I'm looking forward to it.
Same here. Cody Saftik, thanks so much for returning to Josh Nason's Punch Out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right. Big thanks to Cody Saftik for dropping by, hanging with us for 90 minutes. Hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. We have one more to go, and we'll wrap up 2017. I promise this will get out. And last year, I did not do Q4 for whatever reason. I think I just got way behind. I promise the show will come out and within just over a week or so, 2 weeks. Because this week, coming up, Jack Encarnacio, old friend of the show, a longtime friend of the show, very first guest. He and I are going to do a history of the UFC in Boston as UFC 220 is coming up on Saturday night. Big pay-per-view from Boston, Massachusetts at the TD Garden. So I figured let's look back. Since I'm from this area, let's look back at the history of UFC in the Garden and all the fun things that happened, memorable moments, and so on and so forth. So that'll be coming up later this week. And let's see, we had UFC St. Louis last night, and I would grade the overall show a B. I have not seen the Fight Pass portion of the broadcast yet, and it's going to be, again, with so many shows, it's going to be probably tough for me to get to see them. I'm hopefully going to get a chance to see them coming up this week. Let's kind of just go over the quick hit result, or just see if there's anything that really stands out to me. Again, this is the UFC's first event of the year. And overall it was a B. You know, interesting results. Obviously, Jeremy Stephens looking great in defeating Duhua Choi. I don't think this puts him near title contention by any means. I think it puts him in interesting fight category next. You know, he's won two in a row. Before that, just kind of been up and down a lot with losses and wins. Entertaining fighter, of course, but somebody that really kind of needs a big string of wins together to get back to Max Holloway. You have a few other interesting winners. Of course, Paige VanZant losing on the main card to Jessica Rose Clark. I don't really see like star potential in Rose Clark, but I think, you know, she's obviously do what she had to do to defeat Paige VanZant, who had a broken arm in, what, the first round or so. Kamaru Usman did not look great. I mean, he was dominant, but he didn't look great, entertainment value-wise in his win over Emil Meek. So I tweeted last night that, you know, everyone was saying, oh, the Covington-Usman fight, you know, definitely going to happen or should happen. On paper, it should. I don't think, and especially listen to Dana White afterwards, I don't think that's close to happening just yet. I think they really want to make Covington Woodley, and even though you mentioned RDA, my guess is that they're gonna kind of hold Covington aside just in case something happens to RDA going into that. I think they're kind of waiting for that, and he might get another top guy. I don't think Usman, especially that effort last night, and it was solid. I didn't think that was enough to keep him on that the very positive propulsion he was on a little while ago. That could change, but we'll see. And obviously Darren Elkins, interesting guy. Speaking of featherweights, interesting guy there, beating Michael Johnson by submission. Johnson's fifth loss in his last six fights. Is the second round is not his friend, and I think at this point, you know, he's got to get out of the UFC and maybe get some confidence back or something, because it's just not happening for him, especially in the past couple of years. And Darren Elkins, this guy's got a terrible chest tattoo, but just keeps on winning, and it's another big long winning streak for him, and hopefully he gets a very interesting name at 145 next. Could be a Jeremy Stephens situation or somebody like that. You never know. But the rest of the show, Polo Reyes looked really good in defeating Matt Frivola by knockout. The Kang defeating Kennedy, that was interesting as well. That was a pretty solid submission there. And there were all decisions on the fight pass portion, which I have not seen. So, I would say, you know, for what I saw overall, the show was a solid B. And hopefully we get a solid day coming up this Saturday night at UFC 220 in Boston. And again, we'll talk more about that later this week at Jack Encarnacion. So until that time, big thanks to all you guys for listening. Thanks to Cody Saftick. This has been Josh Nason's Punch-Out. Until next time, which will be later this week, insert catchphrase here.